I met you a good few years ago now, and you showed me your business card, and there was a bird on your business card. What is that bird, and why is it important?
So the bird is, it depends what layer of detail you want in this. So the bird is the Blackbird of Belfast. The monks from Bangor Monastery, who brought Christianity to Europe in the 8th century, when they finally reached St. Gallen, which now is the St. Gallen Monastery, which is now Switzerland, they transcribed the Bibles into Latin. But in what they call the glosses on the side of the pages, they wrote poetry.
Wow.
And one of the monks said that no matter how beautiful this place is, he misses the sound of the blackbird in the morning. So the Blackbird of Belfast, which is a famous poem translated by Heaney, translated by Carson, is a great connection to this country. And a great English artist who died last year, Conrad Atkinson, he used to say, Ireland, he said, is a small place, but it sits atop a continent of culture.
Mm.
And he thought this blackbird reference was a great metaphor for the durability, resilience, the beauty of Belfast, and did a famous art exhibition for us called Some Birds Singing, Some Wounds Healing. And the basis of that is, as we said earlier, you know, what sort of day is it? For some people, it's a great day. Many people try to be positive, but for some people, it's a very hard day. So mm-hmm. It's always some birds singing and some wounds healing. Not every wound in this society is healing either. That's the short answer.
That's the shallow answer?
Yeah.
Go a little deeper. Go on.
Well, if you look very closely at the business card, you'll see that there's actually writing on it. And there's writing in Irish on it, because in the artwork that Conrad did, which is really about the peace process in 2007, he was fascinated by the fact that on St. Patrick's Day, in his last entry in his diary, Bobby Sands wrote entirely in Irish, but started by saying in Irish, Tana Henaha, a Kelleru, and you, which means the birds are singing today. So he was taken by this. He was saying, well, it's not a really interesting thing. It all comes back to what we see, what we experience, what we miss, the simple things. So we included those words in the artwork, which really was about how do we help heal this terribly fractured, broken, hurt society. Mm-hmm. So we went through 30 years of terrible war and troubles and darkness, and some people didn't come out the other side, and many people come out the other side wounded and broken. So how do you heal those broken people? And we are probably fairly poor at that. And in fact, we're so poor that we now have intergenerational trauma. And we have the worst mental health indices in Europe. We have the worst suicide levels in Europe. And we have probably the worst failing health service in Europe. So all those things combined, dealing with a problem no one else in Europe suffered a crisis, puts us where we are today. So from one little card comes a lot of levels. So people say to me, that's a lovely card. And occasionally we'll go a little bit deeper with them into the reason for the business card. But Conrad Atkinson himself is such a hero. So what you do is you provide a platform for people to come in and tell people a little bit about their lives. So you're actually, you know, shining a light on other people. And what Conrad Atkinson did for this place, he was the only artist ever banned from the Ulster Museum. He was the official artist for the anti-landmine campaign in the US veterans. You know, this you know, the damage that landmines cause afterwards. But a great English radical artist from Cumbria, and he devoted a lot of his time to painting this place. He used to say, no one ever made money painting Northern Ireland, but he did in the 70s. And of course, in later years, in the noughties, and in 2015, when the Wolverhampton Art Gallery opened, they bought the piece that had been banned by Ulster Museum for a six-figure sum and hung it in a full wall in Wolverhampton. So he saw that wheel turn. But he himself is worth celebrating. So if nothing else, when I pass that business card to people, it reminds him of Conrad Atkinson and what a great hero he was, what a great artist he was, and how he brought so much healing to people through his art. So
cast your mind back, right? Childhood, boyhood. When did you start to get into things like poetry and art? When did that start to stir you?
Well, the first thing we really got into was the Irish language. And so that was the door into so much else, into, you know, to history, to heritage, to poetry. And we got into the Irish language because, amazingly, when guys in green uniforms and carrying guns are walking up and down outside your street and raiding your home and throwing you out of your bed and arresting people in your family, you have this desire to be different from them and to give expression to your opposition to this way we lived in Andersontown in the mid-70s with, you know, Catesmen Park was a fort for the British Army. St. Genevieve School was occupied by the British Army. The apartments, the Masonettes, we call them nearby, were occupied by the British Army. There was Fort, there was Silver City, there was Fort Mona, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we lived under occupation in the 70s in Andersontown. And there were many ways to voice opposition to that. But one of the ways we found, which was more fun as well, was we went to an Irish language club called the Cumann Cluain Ard, which is effectively an Irish language university. All politics left at the door. All religion left at the door. But they taught us the Irish language, and we were able to get a pint of beer after class, which was fantastic. And that really gave us a gateway into a completely different world, the whole, first of all, into the island, into a 2,000-year-old language, and into poetry that way. So I think that was my door into it. I don't think I'm a great aficionado of the arts, but my interest in the arts is what they can do to build up community and what they can do to heal broken society. So that's my interest. So I've a nice collection of some people call it political art, I would call it peace art, but art which has made a difference in the peace process. And when you look at our dear friend Michael Longley and his great poem about ceasefire, if you look at Seamus Dean, Heaney as well, of course, but also the right up to this present day, Michael McGee with his new novel, which is really about growing up West Belfast after the peace process. I think what the artists have done to try and replace war with peace, to replace hatred with love, is absolutely incredible. So we don't do enough of that. We have a pathetic budget for the arts, absolutely pathetic. It's lower now than it was in 2010. And I think it's always a good day. A day to celebrate our artists is a good day.
Mm.
It's another short answer.
That's good. We're all about short answers here. It's the only way to fill up 60-minute slots. So, you know, keep the short answers coming. What was childhood like growing up for you? Tell me about your home life. What were you interested in?
It was just fantastic. We grew up in Andersontown. Everybody really in the street had big families. I'm from a family of seven. My wife's from a family of seven. My two best friends are families of seven. So, you know, make love, not war. Make love, not war, and get educated was the way out. You know, the way out, the way up, the way forward was to get educated. And I came from a family of very ordinary working class people, Catholics in the Northern State, hard station. My mother's father was shot, wounded in 1922. His brother shot dead beside him, and a third brother shot and injured in an attack on their home by loyalists, the new police force, and so on and so forth. And yet we grew up in a home which was wholly apolitical.
Wow.
No Irish music even in it, no GAA in the home, and certainly no Irish language, and no politics, never discussed.
You know. I'm surprised by that. That's not what I would have thought.
No.
Why did they run it like that?
Well, that was just their normality. They had seven children. They were focused on, you know, trying to bring up these seven children at a time when the only way they really knew they would get work unless they emigrated was get educated.
Right.
And not unusual in that, by the way. I think we're an unusual family. Maybe we more families maybe would have had a GAA tradition, but GAA wasn't as big then as it is now. Like, it's absolutely huge. It's a great unifying force across the country and a great force of good for community. So I remember when the internees, which is August 71, and then we'd get little leaflets around the doors. There was lots of trouble in our estate in Andersontown. But I remember a little leaflet coming in and just Datner printed 2-page about the torture of internees and saying to my mother, like, that can't be true, because we're watching TV, and TV certainly a little bit we watched, and, you know, she didn't answer, but of course we know now it was true, internees were tortured. So it was a really fantastic, loving family. My father was a sheet metal worker. He was very ill. He worked in Harland and Woof and Shorts. I tell my DUP friends that. He didn't get into Mackey's. They stopped him at the gate at Mackey's. They said, we don't employ Catholics. But he worked in both. He was called Sammy Miller, of course. But he worked in both Shorts and Harland and Woof. He was ill for a while, for 3 years. We had a health service and a welfare safety net which worked in the 1960s, so like 60 years ago, Matthew. Mm-hmm. And today we don't. So even though my father was sick for 3 years, he got the sick payment.
Right.
And my mother used to say that that was enough. There was five of us then. That was enough to get him through. And only one Christmas he had to go to St. Vincent de Paul. And my mother, recalling it, said, I think they gave us a chit for £10 in the shop at Christmas. And she said, you know, it was a pound. Mm. So 1962, St. Vincent de Paul gave him a pound because his sick money came late. And another great sign of community and our great organization, St. Vincent de Paul and the Salvation Army, another great organization. So despite tough times, we lived in a council house. There was a welfare system that worked. And then he re-educated himself, became a teacher.
Wow.
In mathematics in the secondary school, Christian Brothers Secondary School in West Belfast. So fascinating people, tough times, didn't drink, really tried to keep their family out of the political strife and out of the troubles, and only succeeded partially in that.
I was going to say.
So really delighted, I think, when they saw the peace process started, as we all were. But interestingly, and I tell this to my Republican friends at the time, my mother set up the first peace people organization in 1972. Her friend, mother of 11 children, Martha Crawford, was shot dead. In a gun battle, shot dead by IRA in a gun battle in Holy Thursday, 1972. And then a lot of women in the estate came together and set up the peace people. So our windows were smashed by the IRA. They smashed five or six windows in the street with a message about, you know, plastic kneecaps for your men and shaved heads for your women and so on. So that peace movement, it's not as famous as the second peace movement in 1976, but it was an interesting time because, you know, they really, all they wanted to do was they wanted the war to stop on the streets.
Mm.
They wanted just to focus on their families. And of course, you know, that message was a very important message, but it never, I think, took hold at that time, sadly. So there you are, a few surprises for you.
That's great. That's really great. You end up buying the Andytown newspaper.
Well, I went to work for the Andytown News, so I was very involved through the Irish language. I became involved in campaigning against the hate blocks with Irish language organisations. Then, 1982, went to work for the Andytown News as a journalist. Joined Sinn Féin around the same time, very active in politics. So, I mean, you couldn't have worked anywhere else but somewhere in West Belfast. I worked for the Andytown News. And from 1987, the partner started to retire. So I bought all three partners out over 15 years. And when you're, you know, in your 30s, you think 15 years is a lifetime, and maybe it is. But as each partner retired, I bought them out under a wonderful project, which accountants will be delighted at, that we paid an annuity. So I didn't have any money. But they said, okay, will you pay us over 15 years out of the profits of the company?
Yeah.
And the, you know, late 90s, the noughties were very good years for paper. So we managed to do that and then set up some other projects as well. As you know, Matthew, they say if you want to make a small fortune, take a large fortune and invest it in newspapers. But they were good years. They were good years for the retiring partners and good years for me as well. And we were able to try other projects and build the premises and so on in West Belfast. But, and I don't think I'm unique in this, but my interest in business is only about building community.
Mm.
Of course, it's nice if you have a profitable business. A business that isn't profitable is just so stressful and unsustainable as well. But my interest in business was and is to find out how I can make communities stronger, how I can bring people together. And if you can do that, and lots of businesses do that, and you know, some of them are very famous, that's much more fulfilling than just, you know, I didn't really just want to run a garage, and that's a wonderful profession you want to, but I wanted to be involved in the business which actually has an impact on community. So that fit the bill.
Mm-hmm. For someone listening to this, because that deal that you structured with the partners and the owners of Andytown, how'd they go about trusting you, or what did they see in you? Because that was a bit of a gamble on their end too, wasn't it?
Funny, it's interesting you say that because remember, first of all, you can't sell a third of a paper.
Right.
And there was three partners retiring at different years. Number two, who was going to buy a third of the Andytown News during really tough times? you think it's polarized today, how polarized people were. So you're absolutely right, they took a gamble. I think they saw that I was fairly ambitious.
Right.
because not everybody in your business and all the business I've been involved in over time, you say someone, we'd like to be a shareholder. And not everybody wants that,
right,
which is interesting. So they saw that I was ambitious. I wanted to be a shareholder. I wanted to be an owner. And they did take that gamble. And, you know, it paid off for all of us. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. And by the way, I met someone recently who's retiring and was able to dig out that old contract because it was a signed contract. PwC charges a fortune for doing it, and they haven't got any cheaper. But it was a novel and very useful way to do it. But by the way, made us all reliant on each other. Isn't that a great way to be as well? Mm-hmm.
It was a gamble for you too. As you say, 15 years, that's a half of your life at that point.
Yeah.
So what did you see?
Well, they didn't all retire at the same time, so it was closer to 20 or 21 years. I believe fervently and still believe that, you know, strong voices for community are a building block of successful communities. Now, it used to be only a newspaper, maybe it can be a website now, maybe it can be a podcast, maybe it can be a radio station. But I do believe that strong, resilient, democratic, healthy, growing societies, prosperous societies, current societies should have at their core a voice. Mm-hmm. And the Anderson Town News for me was that voice. Other voices today, of course. And I thought that was a really great opportunity to say, well, can you make this stronger? And can you make this community stronger? And then can you take it and try and achieve the goals of the peace process, which are reconciliation, peace, and social justice? That's hindsight,
right,
saying I wanted to do it. But at the time, certainly, it seemed to me, look, it was a good opportunity. But we also grew it because I was still am very interested in the Irish language. So we were able to buy out and buy the Irish language daily newspaper, La. Most famous now because the editor is the father of NECAP. and we brought that into our stable and we were able to run that with government support for maybe 10 years. So we were able to do other things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I saw. But, you know, I know there's been a discussion today about can people do politics and do other things. The Janet Mann and the SDLP is a wee bit of trouble in Justin and Stormont for that. But actually it meant that I could become a Sinn Féin councillor in 1987. And I was the only Sinn Féin councillor who also had a job outside of the party.
Interesting.
And that was important to me. So I had this other connection and a full-time job and did the council thing part-time. I don't think any other job would have given me that flexibility to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So listen, it's been very rewarding.
Right.
And today, one of the problems we have with, I think, social media and with the polarization of society, the alienation of young people, is that everybody's now a publisher. Anything can be said. There are no rules. And I think we're probably weaker for that as a society. I think social media is weakening us,
mm-hmm,
despite its massive advantages. It's weakening us as a society, as a democratic society, as a united community, than it is strengthening us. But there you go.
It's tough because I would have been, and I suppose to a certain extent, very much still am, trying to go back. So trying to go back to a time where social media wasn't there, and it's not possible. Like the genie's out of the bottle. So we have to find a way forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm out of politics since 2020, and I don't know what the personal reasons Leo Varadkar said yesterday for his resignation. But how anybody can remain in political life with the level of vitriol, abuse, trolling, intimidation, harassment, and social media. It is beyond me. Mm-hmm. It is really beyond me how anybody would opt to go into a profession where you're just open season in social media every day, every minute of the day and night. So I don't know if that's part of the personal reason he talked about, but
yeah.
I think it's been a real undermining of mores of,
yeah,
rules of society, how we live our lives.
I think it's interesting because there's kind of three camps, right? The first camp is Joe Bloggs has a social media account. No one knows who they are. There's a level of invisibility. Maybe they're friends, maybe they're family, but they're not getting onslaughted usually. Yeah. Yeah. Then you've like, let's call them A-listers, like big dogs, who they don't touch their profiles. there's a million miles away from them, and they have a team, and there's an everything. But it's the people in the middle. You know, I'm thinking, I never actually thought about this till you said it. It's the Northern Irish politician. It's the Northern Irish business owner who maybe is just, they're not on Joe Bloggs level. They're not on Brad Pitt level, but they're in that middle zone where they're managing their accounts and all those messages go straight to them. That's got to be a hard place to be in.
So I'm going to tell you something you're not going to hear very often. I agree with Arlene Foster. I believe you shouldn't be allowed to be on Twitter unless you've got your ID in there and who you are. And a bit like Airbnb, I have an Airbnb account, and you know, yeah. So I put on my passport and that's who I am. So I think that the absolute absence of rules, and you know, people have done more work on this than me, but you know, the way we're fueling hate, we're paying for hate. I mean, who would have thought you could live stream slaughter people in a mosque on be your own publisher for that?
Mm-hmm.
But basically, anything goes, and I think that, you know, in newspapers, we have to have rules because the courts insist on rules. And some people say that the libel laws are too strict here. Nevertheless, it's a set of rules which we live by. So if you're the impartial reporter, you can't say that so-and-so is a bank robber unless it's true, because those are the rules. Whereas in Twitter, you can say that and you can say much worse than that.
Right.
And anyone who believes that young people in particular, particularly young girls, aren't damaged and hurt by stuff said on social media, ad hominem, no rules. You know, I think it's weakening us as a society. Anyway, that's another discussion. But back to newspapers, how do you hell then do you? Somebody said to me yesterday, you know, we have a new app for the Irish Echo, which I publish in the States. And they said, well, how do you make money of that? And I said, well, actually, that doesn't make money.
Right.
We pay for that because we run events.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're down to the weakening of journalism. So let's
zoom in. Like, as you say, you know, newspaper kind of had its, you did very well in newspapers at a certain stage, and then everything changed, you know, everything changed. So how have you, as a business owner and as someone interested in the industry, navigated that complete topsy-turvy shift that's gone on?
Well, if you weren't really committed to it, you'd probably jack it in.
Right.
So, and I think over the next 5 years, you'll see a lot of the local newspapers across the north in particular, either amalgamate, go under, because they don't get the government ads. So I came here today, I saw an ad for the health department, I saw an ad for the economy department, I saw an ad for the justice department. None of that goes into the local papers. So they are struggling. The local furniture shop gets good return from Facebook, so why wouldn't they go on Facebook?
Right.
There are things we can do they can't do. We can write a story about your shop, we can do a nice video and so on. But by and large, the newspapers are getting weaker and weaker.
Mm-hmm.
How we have navigated is we organize a lot of events.
Right.
And our events are the fuel for the journalism. But even then, we have fewer journalists now than we ever had.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully that will stop now and will stabilize. But I saw a newspaper in Washington, D.C., an online newspaper let 300 journalists go. It was called The Messenger in January. So if you're New York Times and you have 6 million or 7 million subscribers paying $8 a month, well, that's a model.
Mm-hmm.
That model doesn't work for us. So people say, well, why don't you charge the people of Pole Glass? Charge them £1 a month.
Right.
The people of Pole Glass won't pay £1 a month to read the Anderson Town News. So if we're writing about the necessity to get vaccines, when I was a young man, when I was a boy, no one said that you shouldn't get your MMR vaccine or your measles vaccine. Yet today, that's a reality. It's reality in Anderson Town. There are people in Anderson Town who will say, we're not taking this vaccine. If we do an article about, listen, this is why it makes sense, if we want people to read that, Pole Glass and Lagmore and Andy Town and Ballymurphy, we can't have a paywall. So that's a choice for us. So we're running events, and the events are the fuel for the journalism. But despite that, we're much weaker than we were some years ago. So say Levy, we have to roll with that. In the US, we have, of course, Yanks love congratulating each other. So it's easy to run events there. So the Irish 40 under 40, the Irish Law and Order Awards, the Irish Firefighter Awards, the Irish Heroes of Irish America, and so on and so forth. But I don't know what the model for other people are. Some are trying to have paywalls and have you know, pay to view and so on. I think they're having mixed results from that, but
sure,
you know, you certainly will have less readers.
Yeah, I heard something really, really class last week about musicians. Yeah. They said back in the day, musicians would go on tour to sell their albums. And they say now musicians will stream all their music for free to sell tours.
Yeah, there's a model.
It's very similar to what you're talking about, where the product now isn't the newspaper, the product is the events, and the media is a way to drive bums and seats to the events in a way.
Yeah, and we shouldn't be, you know, have a rose tinted glasses in this. The music industry was always very brutal and cruel and tough, and the newspaper industry was always, you know, very tough as well.
Mm-hmm.
However, someone who's interested in the well being of this city, I think we need more journalists, we need more you know, support from government for that. In France, even Le Mans gets several million euro a year from the French government. So we're actually behind the European curve, behind the Republic of Ireland as well, in terms of saying, look, sink or swim, mm-hmm. we're not going to interfere with this. So.
How do you navigate genuine support with keeping your impartiality as a media company? Like you mentioned the French government, if the French government was given, you know, this podcast, 7 million,
you wouldn't take it.
it would be interesting to see how it would muddy the waters.
Yeah, it would just be your French coverage might be straight.
You'd see me on Duolingo starting to learn the French language. Yeah.
Well, the BBC does a reasonably good job of it, wholly paid for by us. Mm-hmm. And they live or die by their impartiality. And you see great journalism, people like William Crowley and their news team and so on, their spotlight team. So I think we either say we want our newspapers to be gone, mm-hmm. and we'll just throw it open, we're going to rely on Facebook, and the profit's going to go to Mr. Zuckerberg, yeah. or Mr. Musk or whatever for Twitter. Or we say we want to try and find a model, mm-hmm. which means that there is a voice for local communities, which they trust, which holds the powers that be accountable, which is based on fact, which is independent, but based on fact. And if we want that be in communities, then we need to support that. In the US, what they have is they have a project now where they train journalists and then they drop them into what they call news deserts.
Okay.
Places right across the US, Louisville, Kentucky, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Boot, Montana, where the local newspapers have closed. And maybe there's an online newspaper only, and they train the journalists, and then they say, okay, you're going to do 2 years out in Idaho. And they're trying to, in that way, support democracy, have fact-based reporting, have the principles of journalism endure and live on. So I'm for government intervention in this. The government intervenes in many, many other ways. And, you know, unless you're a Thatcherite, I think we need to find a model to do that. Of course, the advertising model is easiest if the Department of Justice has ads on TV relating to this. You can find out if your spouse or partner or boyfriend was a sex offender. Why can't some of that advertising revenue fall down in the local newspapers as well and on our websites? But it doesn't. So,
is there a reason why government's not running ads in newspapers?
Yeah, I think because Facebook has a bigger reach.
Right.
So they're going just for the metric. So it doesn't matter if Facebook's also live streaming the slaughter of people in a mosque.
Right.
It doesn't matter if that environment or if it's open season, you can say whatever you want. They said, so we'll put our ads on Facebook and Twitter. It always depresses when I see ads for Libraries NI on Twitter. Wow, you know, we need people to read. But anyway, so that's the life. So if you understand the price of everything and the value of nothing, mm-hmm. then you'll always just go for Facebook.
I never even really thought that the money is effectively being put into, you know, big US tech companies rather than small independent journalisms or just journalists in general.
And, you know, the interesting thing is when we meet shop owners, I understand a shop owner saying, look, I only use Facebook, mm-hmm. But then Amazon puts them out of business because, you know, even I met a guy who sells little trinkets for Christmas trees. Mm-hmm. And he said, I always did well. He said, not doing well this year. He said, Amazon's taking my business.
Right.
It's so easy now. You go and say, trinkets, Christmas
yep.
tree.
Yep.
The basics. So we now have, I don't know if you've been in Porto down High Street, or in Uri.
Uri last week.
Those are the two worst towns in terms of empty shops.
Yeah.
So we need to be aware of the changes that are coming, societal changes, and how we mitigate against them, because Amazon's fantastic if you want that.
Yeah.
Profits go somewhere else. They're employing some people, they're non-union. But what if then you're going to have an empty high street? Who's going to pay for that if our high streets are dilapidated and we make our communities weaker? So What I would always say to government is be aware of it, be ahead of the curve, and AI is coming next. What effect's that going to have? And is our government ready for that?
Right.
Try and manage and mitigate. They're ready in California. You know, you meet labor union, trade union leaders in California.
Yeah.
They're spending a lot of time thinking about AI. How will it affect?
Well, that's the thing, because it's not just the Christmas tree trinkets seller. It's the people that are sitting doing work out there that you think there's no way a machine could do that, but actually there's machines already doing it.
Yeah. So,
that'll be interesting.
So we need to be aware, will AI help humanity mm-hmm. or will it control us even more? And those are big questions. And our government, our local government in particular, needs to be aware of these things, because you'll end up with a society maybe which is hollowed out, mm-hmm. which everything's just done for profit.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the best way. Mrs. Thatcher maybe thought it was, but I don't think anybody really agrees with that anymore.
Where do you think the news deserts are in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think every local newspaper has probably a quarter of the number of journalists they had 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you're talking about Newton Arch, Bangor, Ballymena, wherever, those areas, the newspapers still exist. They aren't as strong. Some of them are selling very small print numbers because print is dying. Maybe probably never ever die completely. It's dying. So all those areas, I mean, I don't have the figures for the number of journalists, but you will know because I'm sure you get the odd press release. The majority of journalists end up working for PR firms and moving across. With the exception of the BBC, I don't think journalism is growing anywhere in terms of numbers.
Right.
So occasionally I'm in the Basque country, which, you know, Bilbao or Donosti, San Sebastian, and occasionally I see a press conference. I see a throng of journalists because they have two, maybe three Basque language TV stations, maybe seven radio stations, all supported by the government, or they wouldn't be able to exist. Then they have the Spanish language ones, then they have the local ones. And then when I come to a press conference here, it strikes me, wow, we have such a paucity of journalism. So, which is healthier? My view, you know, the more journalists, the better, within reason. So I think sometimes we see everything just through our local. So well, that's it, this way it has to be.
Yeah.
You know, we need to really look at how other societies and other successful countries organize themselves.
How did you get into the Irish Echo and why?
Well, I'm a big believer in community. So, yep. You know, the Antietown News is a great voice for the West Belfast community, North Belfast News, CM. But the Irish America is just a community. It's just a community of 40 million people. Somehow or other, the figures went up in the last census, up 7 million. People who said, are you Irish America? Yourself designate. And it's just a community. It's a fascinating community to me. I've always felt indebted to that community when I was a young man in terms of their interest. And a lot of human rights lawyers came here in the 70s and 80s when things were tough. But as well as that, we had no peace process without Irish America. For me, the transformation, my lifetime, and the greatest gift we ever received was the ceasefires and the peace process.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we wouldn't have that without America, and you wouldn't have had that without Irish America. So I've always been really fascinated by that society. But, you know, like a kid, I read the DC comics, I read the Marvel comics. So America, and I'm unique in this, America just fascinated me. So the opportunity to define those two, to combine those two great loves, love of America and love of newspapers by acquiring the Irish Echo in 2007 was too good to pass up. Now, let me give you a bit of advice, Matthew.
Please do.
Never buy a newspaper in 2007.
Noted. Daniel, make a note of that. We'll put that up on our wall.
So we had just sold with the great Peter Quinn, the former president of the GAA, we'd sold a newspaper group in Dublin. And we did very well. We sold it to the Irish Times, who were buying newspapers in 2006, 2007. And instead of putting that money in my children's trust fund, we turned around and put it into the Irish Echo. And the Irish Echo has been such a great experience. Smaller now in terms of journalism, still, you know, a large 68-page newspaper, St. Patrick's Day. Subscribers right across 50 states. We make money off the print subscriptions posted out to people.
That's crazy.
We have a new app out. We're on the web at irishecho.com. But to be able to be involved with that community, so I was in the States 10 times last year. I've been twice this year, but I was there 10 times last year to get into the real below the skin of the Irish American community, to be able to be supportive of it, but also to tie them back into the work we're doing here, especially the city of Belfast, the economic development, the academic links, the work of peace building, reconciliation, social justice. That has been a great trip, I think they call that in the American news, but it's been a great ride, as the Yanks would say. And it's been fascinating. And of course, there aren't a lot of independent newspapers left on these islands or in the US. And we're holding on. The Irish Echo will be 100 in 2028. I'd like to be on planet Earth in 2028, but that would be a really special occasion. We have a model that works. And at the minute we do, but it's not easy. Mm-hmm. But we have a great editor, Ray O'Hanlon, who's really the eminence grease of Irish American reporting, and a great team in New York, small office, Madison Avenue.
But very good.
At the bottom of Madison Avenue, it's very cheap.
It doesn't matter. It's very cheap. You've got the Mad Ave address.
Yeah. And so we have a model that works. People are, you know, there's four or five people making a living off it, paying their mortgage and so on. And I'm able to do what I do and link it back in. So listen, I'm very pleased with that, very lucky to have that.
It's very interesting, you know, the symbiotic relationship almost between here and there. So as you say, you know, America's played a big role in our history and we play a big role in their identity.
Yeah, and they are still a people who are often searching for an identity. It's such a young nation. You know, the native peoples were subject to genocide and destruction. And yet it makes them better Americans. It makes them more whole as Americans. They can serve both masters. They're happy to be Italian American and find out about those roots. They are a dislocated people in many ways, in that, you know, when they, and we can't, it's very hard for us to imagine. What's it like if your people left Belfast or Cork in 1810, maybe especially after the Great Hunger, maybe 1840, and went to found their way out to the West, and you finally make your way back to Ireland almost 200 years later. It's a fascinating phenomenon that 2019, 2 million Americans came to the island of Ireland. One in every 10 Americans in 2019 who went to Europe came to Ireland. So there's this fascination, and some of it's shallow, some of it's very deep. And, you know, it just amazes me when I go to some of the big universities that they have always provided refuge and a sanctuary for some of our greatest writers. They have huge libraries. They're very proud of that. It's a relationship. I think it's a two-way street, and it has to be. It's not a begging bowl. It's a two-way street. We give them a lot. My goodness, we could tell them something about the peace process and division as well. Just in a minute, they're so divided, and it's so much vitriol in their political discourse. But it's for me, it's been a great privilege that, and if you're Irish, you're from this island, and you go to America and you need something, they will open the door to you. Now, if you're selling is crap, they're not going to buy it. But actually, if you have something to sell, and increasingly we have something to sell, you will get a listen, and people will open. You're pushing on an open door, as someone once said. So that's the beauty of it. And then you know, you get to walk up Madison Avenue occasionally, which is nice, which is still nice, even though these cities are terribly troubled. San Francisco is a homeless problem, which is indescribable. Mm-hmm. And yet, despite that, you know, in New York, and they say Irish America is finished, but in New York, last Saturday for St. Patrick's Day, 100,000 people marched and 2 million watched. So
we thought we were good at parades.
Yeah. And we have a lot of parades. And you know, there's a move now to try and add depth to that, and Tourism Ireland involved in that. I see the Queen's University route and so on. So it's up to us, I think, to, I don't like using this word leverage, but, you know, can we build a partnership with these people? Can we have them visit more often? Can we help them build their societies and they build ours? So that has to be the aim of the game.
Talk to me about the homecoming.
So
what it is and why you do it.
I was in politics for a while, and I was in Belfast City Hall for a while. And
former Lord Mayor, Daniel.
Yeah, it's
unbelievable. Anyway,
there's at least 60 living Lord Mayors in this city at the minute. But you really saw the love that people have. They wanted to give something back to Belfast. And because we always say part of the Belfast diaspora, that's anybody who wants to come to Belfast. We're very promiscuous and inclusive in this region. But in Detroit in 2014, they started the Detroit Homecoming. Mm-hmm. And Detroit is one of the great cities of America, which has absolutely been emptied out. White flight, population decrease, criminality, crime, homicides, people left the city centre. And a friend of ours who was involved in the business magazine said, we want to start a homecoming. Their homecoming is largely people in the auto industry, the car industry, and also sports stars. And when they come home, they're coming back from LA, they're coming from New York, coming from San Francisco.
Back to the Rust Belt.
And, you know, and Detroit's doing better, but it still has massive, almost prairies, because there's so much demolition and desolation. So we took that idea and said, well, look, what if we had Belfast hang out its brightest colours? What have we agreed for 2 or 3 days when our visitors are in town? Not to fall out, to showcase what we've achieved. And of course, what has been achieved here is miraculous. In my view, it is miraculous. I think a peace process is miraculous. If you look at the technology industry alone, we have 30, 40,000 people employed here. Didn't exist in 1994 with the ceasefires, 1998. And yet you see what Kainos has done, what City has done, what Allstate has done, what some of our local entrepreneurs have done. They have created a technology sector which is not sort of back office jobs. Some of it is, but not back office jobs, but actually people like Liberty IT carrying out 10% of all Liberty's security technology operations around the world from Belfast. So we have something very special here. We've built it over 25 years. So we have something to bring to America. to say, look, we could do more of this. Would you like to partner with us? And by the way, we'd like maybe to teach your people, or we'd like to show you how we did this. So that's the homecoming is saying to people, why don't you come in and find out, come in and enjoy yourself, number one. Come home, and for Irish Americans who haven't been in Ireland, and there are still many, many millions of them, tens of millions who are of the 40 million who say they're Irish American, who designate as Irish American, who are Irish American, I would say at least one quarter or one third have never been to Ireland. Mm-hmm. So you've already market, but come, explore, network, and then partner. So the partner bit is the key bit. What can you give back? And if you're just an ordinary working class Joe, well, maybe you just visit every 3 years. And that's enough. But if you're somebody involved in academia, well, why don't you bring over your sports team, or why don't you link up? So we're sort of doing the work that Joseph Kennedy III's doing. But also, hopefully at home, we're saying to people that the house divided cannot stand. If we want Belfast to be better, we need to find a way to solve our political problems. Delighted to see the government back at Stormont as part of that. Can we embed the peace process? Because the peace process is always under threat. It's always fragile. And then can we deliver social justice? Because we don't have that third element. And I wasn't particularly good at pointing out that third element, I think, when I was in City Hall. But the third element is the absolute foundation. You know, people have to have homes. They have to have work. They have to be treated with dignity. And we need to find a way to do that and pay our way. Mm. And those are the challenges. So I think the homecoming gives us an opportunity to whip it up, let our hair down a little bit, but also make some meaningful connections which will be beneficial to our journey. And I'm looking at the next 25 years. We've done wonders in the last 25 years. I think we just park that and stop talking about it and then say, okay, what do I want to do over the next 25 years?
Mm.
Which I won't be about for all of it, but I might make a contribution at the same
time. How do you deal with all the different birds singing in your ear all the time? You've good stuff going on in your life. You've bad stuff. You've challenges. You've indifference. You've this business. You've that business. You've relationships you're trying to upkeep. How do you manage it all?
Well, I find it as difficult as anyone else. That's why I now leave the phone downstairs, because I was waking up during the night answering emails at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I don't think anybody in this chaotic world we live in, and anybody involved in family and the drama of families and the difficulty of families and world is full of disappointments and suffering and cruelty and so on. So I've been very lucky in my life that no one in my family, immediate family, was lost in the years of darkness here. But I did have a Buddhist chaplain called Paul Haller, who is a lifesaver. When I was Lord Mayor, I rang him up and I said, Paul, will you be my Buddhist chaplain? Because I have the rabbi at Belfast, I have the imam from the mosque, I give the Christians four because they argue a lot. And I said to Paul, will you be my chaplain? And I rang him in San Francisco. And he said, he's from Andytown. He left in 1972. Great year to leave. Matthew, they're all good years to leave. And went east and ended up in Japan and Thailand, then Japan. Became a Buddhist priest and went to San Francisco and took up the highest position in Zen Buddhism in North America, which is the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. He's a great, great son of Belfast. And he said, look, he said, I will be your chaplain. He says, because I have massive experience of dealing with hopeless cases. So I like that attitude, but his main lesson to me was added out the negativity.
Mm.
That's a damn difficult thing to do. But if we're going to get through these days in which we live at all, we're going to have to find ways to add out the negativity. How do you do that when you're in a real world and if you're a newspaper, when there's so much negativity has to be reported on? But I have tried to do that, and I've found that if you edit out the negativity, and what does he mean by that? It means don't talk about other people behind their back. Don't gossip. Don't get involved in saying anything negative about people. And funny, I found in my political life, I met some politicians like that, and I thought, wow, did Paul Haller speak to them too? Because it's a harder station. It's a harder station to say, look, I'm not going to get involved and get distracted about criticizing people. Just stay focused. And try and stay positive, but edit out the negativity. So that's been my best help. But isn't it wonderful to have birds singing in your ear? Mm. Isn't it wonderful to be busy? Aren't we lucky to have, you know, networks that want a little piece of us and able to give something to society? So it's a balance as well. I have a great friend that's in your business, a podcaster, Brian Moran, and he has me dividing my day up into my time, which is before work starts. Downtime is when you prepare. prime time is when I'm not available because I'm just working, trying to get things done. And then my time at the end of the night when I turn on the Disney Channel and watch that All Murders in the House, whatever it's called, or in the apartment or whatever. So that is helping me. But, you know, I don't think anybody has it easy nowadays. This is a tough society we live in. And, you know, I'm not in favour of this, let's bash the Brits. But see the 10 years of austerity we had here from 2010 to 2020, totally unnecessary. You know, saying to people, if you've more than two children, you're not getting family allowance, which was, you know, it was the mainstay of our ability to survive as children in Andersdown. Seven of us was my mother got the family allowance every week. This hostility towards migrants and asylum seekers, and I'm all in favour of, we have to control borders and have to have the balance in these things. But austerity under the Tories, and I'm not really in favour of this idea, just bashing Tories too, but that damaged us as a society, and it's made life so much tougher. These zero-hour contracts, these low-paid jobs, the inability to get housing. So, look, we have to sort it out ourselves. London isn't going to sort it out for us. Dublin isn't going to sort it out for us, though they're being more and more helpful. So we need to find a way forward to build a society which is more prosperous and which looks after the least of these as well. So that's the objective. But we're back in the austerity, and I hate seeing it. And our health service is absolutely broken. But we're going to have to find a way out of this, because I think there's no cavalry coming over the hill to save us.
Thank you for your time, Martin. Really appreciate it.
Look, thank you very much.
What a way to end.
Matthew, listen, thanks very much. Keep doing what you're doing. You have a great story to tell. We have a great city to boast about. So let's keep it as positive as possible.
100%. Okay.